OMI or scan-based trading. But whenever possible, I recommend that small business owners seek these arrangements with their vendors as they free up cash for the business, yet allow for a wider assortment of goods to be available. These kinds of terms can often be established with vendors who are looking to gain a foothold in a market. So be on the lookout for these opportunities. Radio frequency identification, or RFID, which has become important in inventory management, offers a new level of inventory visibility at the individual item level on the shelf. It can be programmed to help companies like P&G ensure that the first moment of truth is fulfilled by actively pinging store managers when a product is down to its last few units on the shelf. This can prevent stockouts that often occur because of failures to replenish store shelves. In sum, there is immense change altering the logistics landscape and the means by which companies are achieving reach in the market. Some products no longer even need to move by physical means. This lecture, for instance, was once delivered exclusively on CD or DVD format. Today, I suspect that many of you are streaming it over the internet. Media products that can be broken down into data bits move in a virtual sense today. And with the advent of 3D printing, which we've considered previously, physical products may move in a similar manner on a larger scale soon. Clearly, much has changed in logistics, but even greater change could still be upon us. I'm excited about how these technologies can transform the ways we live and do business.
This lecture is titled, Rethinking Your Business Processes.
Processes fill our lives. Virtually everything we do involves a process. Whether it's making a product, filing a legal brief, performing a surgical procedure, completing a tax return, delivering a lecture, or digging a ditch. But even though they go on all around us, we tend not to notice processes or really think deeply about them very often. Hopefully, after this lecture, you will, because finding ways to improve processes has become indispensable to business success. I'm going to provide you with some simple tools and methods for figuring out how to improve the processes that matter to your organization. Every process can be improved. This is a principal belief of the world's highest performing and most admired organizations. Companies like Apple, Google, Amazon, and Toyota are always pressing for better products, services, and ways to bring more value to market. By constantly challenging themselves, they believe that they can stay ahead of competitors who are less inclined to adapt and change. In this way, they have an intrinsic motivation that supersedes anything that the competition might throw at them, as they relentlessly pursue improvement. At Toyota, every team member is not only encouraged, but expected to call out problems, or so-called defects in the processes in which they participate. Imagine a work environment in which everyone is focused on doing things better and solving problems. An environment focused on adding value through work that truly matters. These are the organizations that frustrate the competition because they never stand still. Learning the basics of process thinking will enable you to bring that same kind of focus on improvement to your business. So what is process thinking? In a nutshell, it's a method for figuring out what work really needs to get done and how to get the most out of our time and resources. Process thinking embraces the mantra of doing the right things right. Let's break that down. Doing the right things means focusing your efforts on outcomes that create what I call defensible value. Defensible value means that you can rationalize the efforts involved in pursuing some desirable outcome, that the effort is worth it. You need to be able to defend this value in your eyes, the eyes of your organization, and the eyes of the customers you serve. This can often be achieved by simply talking out the work. By rising above the work to explain what we do and why, we often realize that we find ourselves consumed with activities that perhaps don't need to be performed, or at least not by us. Why? Because the work does not yield defensible value. We are not focusing on the right things. The other half of the doing the right things right mantra, doing things right, refers to performing work in the most efficient manner possible. So once we figure out what needs to get done, we concern ourselves with how. Let's start, though, by talking a little more about the right things. In business, we often speak of two voices that we should listen to when making any business decision. These are the voice of the customer and the voice of the business. The voice of the customer, as its name implies, means hearing what customers have to say, what they're seeking in the way of product or service attributes, but more importantly, the outcomes that customers are looking to have fulfilled through the products and services they buy. Those outcomes, given a price, the customers pay for them, render an assessment of value. Value is therefore defined as quality given the price paid. In keeping with our discussion so far, let's focus on outcomes rather than quality. For outcomes are really what customers want. Not just something that looks and performs as expected. Does the product use or the service experience satisfy or better yet delight the customer? Those are outcomes and they apply equally to products or services. In order to address those outcomes, it certainly helps if we take the time to listen to customers and understand their needs before engaging in a series of hit and miss efforts that will result in frustration for the customer and for us. Let's try to get it right the first time. The voice of the customer concept reminds us that the right things for us to do should be in line with providing outcomes that customers want and are willing to pay for. This last piece, the willing to pay for, brings in the voice of the business. The voice of the business directs our attention to the needs of the business, the needs for revenue, profitability, growth, image, stature, meaningful jobs for employees, all of that. In order for the business to survive and thrive, it must look after these needs. Suffice it to say that the right things for the business to pursue are those things that generate value in the eyes of customers and generate the business outcomes that your organization needs. So once you've figured out what outcomes to pursue, the next logical question becomes how to do these things right. That is, how to achieve efficiency and effectiveness in the work processes performed. The first step is to understand the current state of your processes, or how work is currently performed. Only then can you seek to make things better through what is called continuous improvement. What process or processes should you consider first? I recommend starting with one that's in clear need of help. Is there a part of your life or business that's causing a lot of stress for you? Maybe customers are complaining or your own colleagues are pressing you about something. Is this a stress that others feel too? This might be a good place to start. Don't be discouraged by having to change the minds of others or by perceived resistance that you might encounter when talking about change or the need for improvement, for change is difficult for all of us. What process thinking does better than any other method is help others to feel the pain that you experience in your work processes and to see the pain that customers experience in the process. How is this done? By making processes visual. Process thinking brings processes to life by capturing them in simple diagrams called process maps. A process map takes us through a process step by step. You can make one by using PowerPoint or other software, but you don't have to. All you really need to get started are some post-it notes, a large sheet of paper or poster board, and a good understanding of the work steps involved. It helps if you can get the various people involved in the process to help you devise the map. Let's walk through an example. Any kind of process will do. So let's pick one that just about everyone is familiar with. Taking a trip by commercial airline. I'd like to encourage you to think about this process and your own experiences as I describe my experience in 8 distinct steps, which I'll lay out in the process map in a line from left to right. Upon learning that I must take a trip by plane, I start by researching the ticket. This research usually involves going to the website of my preferred airline and checking the flight availability and prices. Occasionally, I search additional airlines, but most times I can find an acceptable set of flight options and prices at my preferred carrier. I'll bundle all of the research activities into one step here and put it at the beginning of the process map. There's no need at this point to complicate the map with all the intricacies of what researching flight options entails. I find that limiting the process map to between 8 and 12 steps is good enough for a first pass. We can always dive deeper and add more detail in a second pass if we find a trouble spot requiring deeper analysis. Okay, back to our map. Once I've completed my research on the flight options, I perform the next step of buying the ticket. So I'll add that to the map. If the first step does not happen, I cannot move to the second step. Notice also that we're focused on the way the process is typically performed. There are always exceptions, and sometimes we want to focus on how we address these exceptions, but we usually stand to improve most by examining how we deal with normal circumstances. So in this case, we transition from researching to buying the ticket. The third step in the process does not happen until some time much later, usually weeks later, when I'm ready to take my trip. In the meantime, I plan the trip activities and pack my bags, but the next action captured on our map occurs once I arrive at the airport. That's step 4, the acquisition of the boarding pass and dropping off my luggage at the airline ticket counter. Here we should indicate on the map that another party, the airline ticket agent, is involved in this step. The involvement of other actors or locations in the process is delineated in a swim lane, an additional line of actions that runs parallel to the main line. Each actor in the process has his or her own swim lane, as does each physical location. When the process moves from one actor to another, we show that transition by drawing a line from one swim lane to another. A similar transition occurs in step 5, clearing security, where we need to add another swim lane to illustrate the handoff in the process to another location and actor. In the next step, step 6, I walk to the gate and submit my boarding pass. Finally, in step 7, I board the plane, take my seat, and ride out the flight until we reach the destination. At which point, I disembark the plane, collect my luggage, that's step 8, to close out the process. This first pass in the process map does not mark the end of the review, but rather the beginning. To the extent that others are involved in the process, you should confer with them to see if their version of the process jives with yours. Is the sequence correct? Are there any glaring omissions? Discrepancies should be discussed and mutually resolved. They may reveal important misunderstandings or conflicts that stand in the way of process improvement. Once agreement is reached on the first pass map, it's a good time to step back and reflect on the process drawn out before you. Ask yourself, does anything seem unnecessary? In fact, is the whole process necessary at all? If you determine that the process remains essential, it's time to do a deeper analysis by populating the basic work steps with additional data, such as the amount of time it takes to complete each step. We call this the process time. We can also estimate the amount of time that is spent waiting within each step, as well as between the various steps. These time data can be observed and measured on what is called a time and motion basis, with an independent observer equipped with a stopwatch monitoring repeated performance of the work steps to derive average values for the process and wait times. Or you can simply ask the people who do the work, what is the typical amount of time it takes for you to complete your work? And how much time do you spend waiting and not actually performing your work? The people who do this work regularly are usually good judges of the time involved. Again, it's helpful if the actors in the process are involved in the analysis too, since we'll be seeking their ideas for improvement and relying on them should we, after the process, change their work in some way. In our air travel example, let's say it takes me about 10 minutes to complete step one, the research of the various flight options. However, let's assume that I don't ordinarily buy the ticket right away, which is the second step. Let's say I wait 2 days. That's just my personal preference, to shop first, then ponder the trip, and not make any rash purchasing decisions. With some reflection and additional trip planning, I may elect to drive or travel by some other means, or I may not elect to take the trip at all. However, most times I will return to the airline website a few days later and complete the purchase of the ticket. The intervening 2 days represent wait time in the process. Purchasing the ticket, step two, requires 10 minutes of process time. But then I wait 3 weeks before performing step three, which is the initiation of the trip itself. Now, why the long wait here? If you travel often by plane, you probably know the answer. The airlines usually charge very high prices for flights in the few weeks preceding travel. This is a simple method of profit maximization for the airlines. They charge higher prices to desperate last-minute travelers and garner the most revenue they can for the last remaining seats on the plane. As a result, I typically buy my airline tickets about 3 weeks ahead of the actual travel. Once we've got time estimates for each step in the process, we can tally the times. The sum of the process times across our 8 steps is 161 minutes. This is the actual amount of time in which I and my fellow process actors are engaged in work associated with booking the flight, reaching my plane, taking the flight, and collecting my luggage. 120 of these 161 minutes are associated with the flight itself. Likewise, we can tally the wait time across the process, which sums to a considerable 23 days, 5 hours. Adding the sum of the process times and the sum of the wait times together, we arrive at what is called the cycle time for the process. This is the total amount of time that elapses from initiation of the process until it's concluded. In our example, the cycle time is 23.32 days. Or 33,581 minutes. Note that the vast majority of cycle time is associated with the 3-week wait that elapsed between buying the ticket and taking the trip. Of the more than 33,000 minutes, only 161 minutes involved actual work performed by the key actors in the process. This amounts to just under 0.5% of the total cycle time. The wait time for a flight might strike you as normal, but what you might find surprising is that such a low level of time efficiency is very common in both personal and business work processes. In fact, it's rare to find a measure of time efficiency greater than 10%. This speaks to the considerable slack or idle time found in most processes. A process map helps to illuminate such slack or wasted time. In addition to analyzing time data, it can also be worthwhile to assess 2 more important aspects of the process. These are the first-time quality and resource availability. First-time quality refers to the percentage of time that a given work step is completed successfully on the first try. In our example, I noted that the vast majority of the time, I'm successful in finding a flight option at an acceptable price, such that I elect to travel by plane instead of using another means of travel or simply not taking the trip. Through simple approximation, I estimate that my first time quality, or FTQ for short, for researching flight options is about 80%. Then, about 95% of the time, I'm successful in actually buying the ticket that I sought to purchase. The other 5% of the time, I lose out on flights that are already booked up or no longer affordable. This could be because of my 2-day delay in booking the flight while I ponder the options. Let's say I enter the first-time quality for the remaining 6 steps on a similar basis. Resource availability refers to the percentage of time that the various resources required to perform a work step are available. I estimate that about 98% of the time I have a working computer and internet connection to conduct my ticket research. On the other end of the transaction, the computer server at the airline needs to be functioning so flight options are available for me to peruse and consider. Like with estimates of FTQ, approximate percentages are good enough. Where ready data exists on aspects of your process map, go ahead and use that data. But for most purposes, the on-the-spot insights of the key actors will suffice. On a related note, where times and percentages vary greatly from instance to instance in a process, some people prefer to capture worst-case scenarios, running with the longer times and lower percentages. This is a fine approach when your greatest concern is dealing with these worst-case scenarios. But more often, we concern ourselves with typical scenarios, and therefore it makes sense to use data that represent normal conditions in the process. Just as we tabulated the summed process time, the summed wait time, and the total cycle time for the process, we can now calculate the first-time quality and availability levels for the whole process. These values are calculated by multiplying all the first-time quality percentages by one another and all the availability percentages by one another for the 8 process steps. The FTQ expressed as a percentage for each step in order is 80, 95, 98, 95, 99, 99.9, 100, and 98%. So roughly, what do you think the final FTQ percentage will be for the whole process? If all 8 steps were conducted at 100% precision, the FTQ would be 100%. But there was only one such activity in our example, getting me to my destination safely, which fortunately is a good one. You know, that's the one that I want to have a very high percentage on. But for each activity that falls short of 100% quality, the total FTQ for the process will head south. And our first activity, researching the ticket, was rated at 80%. So right out of the gate, our FTQ will come in no higher than 80%. After multiplying all 8 FTQ values together, we find that the first time quality yield for the process is 68.6%. In other words, about 70% of the time everything goes according to plan, from the researching of the airline ticket to taking the trip and collecting my luggage at the destination. The other 30 or so percent of the time, something goes wrong somewhere in the process. Does that sound about right for your travel experiences? In a similar fashion, we multiply the availability percentages across the 8 steps, with the steps estimated individually at 98, 99, 95, 95, 95, 99, 99, and 98%. All values in the mid to high 90s, but nothing at 100%. So we expect availability of resources to ratchet downward a little with each step. When we multiply those 8 values, we find that the total availability of the process is 79.9%. So about 80% of the time, the actors and resources are available to do the work when the work is ready. When resource availability is less than 100%, there will be waiting in the process, waiting that can be attributed to lacking resources of some kind. With the calculated totals for first-time quality and availability in hand, look for the biggest culprits that could affect these 2 outcomes. In the case of first-time quality in our scenario, researching the ticket is the major contributor to quality failure with that 80% value. Meanwhile, availability looks to suffer somewhat at the ticket counter, security checkpoint, and the departure gate, all locations for which lines form and waiting occurs. Bear in mind that yields for first-time quality and availability will only decline, or at best, sustain overall performance when more work steps are identified in a process. This is not only a mathematical reality of multiplying their values, but also an operational reality. The more complicated a process becomes, the more opportunities for error, delay, and disruption are introduced. With that in mind, we should seek to simplify our processes by reducing the number of steps involved. This is, in fact, a principle of lean thinking, the popular process improvement methodology I've discussed before. To help in identifying which steps we can eliminate from a process, lean thinking recommends that we can take one more pass through our process map. This time, we assign a subjective label to each work step. That subjective label is whether or not the step is a value-added one. In other words, does the step contribute defensible value to the process? Would the elimination of that step diminish the value of the process outcome in any way? If so, we can label the step as value-added, and it should remain intact in the process. In fact, we might explore ways in which we can add even more value through such a step. But if we can eliminate a step without interfering with the process, it should be labeled non-value-added. Some non-value-added steps may be necessary in our process, however. Observing laws and safety measures might be regarded as non-value-added in the eyes of customers, but we can all agree that they remain essential in our process. These steps are labeled as essential non-value-added or necessary non-value-added. Still, we should look for ways in which we might reduce the time invested in these work steps. Returning to our example, let's assume that I, the customer of the air travel process, take a hardline approach to assessing the value in each work step. Of the 8 steps, I label just 2 as value-added: the air travel itself and collecting my luggage at the destination. What this says is that as the customer and primary actor of the process, I don't especially enjoy or find value in the other steps. If you find joy in shopping for air travel or in one of the procedural steps, then you might consider these as value-added. But in my case, I simply want to reach my destination safely and find my bags on the baggage carousel. Everything else merely assists in making that outcome possible. The 2 value-added steps account for only 121 of the more than 33,000 minutes of the process. So the value-added time accounts for a very small proportion of the total cycle time, just 0.36%. Again, this really low value is not out of the norm for such an analysis. Unfortunately, the 6 so-called non-value-added steps are essential to taking the trip so that I can travel in a safe and secure manner, abiding by established rules and regulations. That said, ample opportunities for improved efficiency can be found. For instance, I could compress the whole process by delaying the search and the purchase of the ticket, though I risk not finding a seat or paying a higher price at the last minute. Also, I could use my smartphone to check in for my flight, streamlining the collection of my boarding pass. I might also join a frequent flyer program that provides privileges like expedited security clearance. And I suppose I could run to my gate rather than walking casually, gaining exercise along the way. The point is that we might scrutinize the process and not simply accept it as a fact of life. This final pass of labeling work steps as value-added or non-value-added converts our process map into what is called a value stream map. This in-depth assessment of the current state of our process allows for the identification of trouble spots in the process, items that cause pain, take too much time, or simply are not needed. What would you like your process to look like in the future? Assuming that you deem the process and its outcomes worth pursuing. To help yourself reach that goal, create a future state map, adjusting the process to fit your vision. If the outcomes are commensurate with or exceed the value of the time, effort, and resources invested, then you can redefine how the work should be conducted in the future. If the outcomes fall short of expectations, don't give up just yet. Determine if there's a way to enhance the value or reduce the inputs poured into the process. The cost-benefit ratio of an altered process might make the process attractive in the end. Keep in mind also that people often don't realize a good thing until it's gone. So be careful when deciding to discontinue a process altogether. When improving a process, it's sometimes a good idea to devise two future state maps, one for the near term and another for the long term. A near-term future state map embodies the improvements that can be made, say, within 3 months with existing resources. This map typically reflects an evolution of the current process, eliminating non-value-added steps, reducing essential non-value-added steps, and looking for ways to enhance the value added. However, when greater change or revolution is sought in a process, then a longer-term future state map is necessary. Revolution calling for dramatic changes in a process might require a change in skill sets, new technologies, or changes in business terms with outside parties like customers and suppliers. These changes cannot happen overnight, so save them for the long-term future state. Process thinking and the mapping procedure that I've described offer an effective way to bring together the actors in any process and to find better ways to do the right things right. Don't allow your processes to operate invisibly. Shine a light on them. Challenge them. Figure out what work really needs to get done and how to do it best. Then perform that work with purpose and passion.
This lecture is titled Measuring Operational Performance.
It's often said that what gets measured gets done. Or, if you cannot measure it, you cannot control it. These are but a few of the seemingly countless mantras around performance measurement. The mere existence of these common expressions underscores the significance we place on measurement in all aspects of business and in life. A performance measure is an expression of health or vitality of an activity or process performed by an individual, a team, or an entire organization. Similar to measures of health for people like body temperature, blood pressure, and pulse rate, business measures should be quantifiable, expressed in numbers. That's what makes a measure a metric, a quantification of a condition. Metrics should also be precise and reliable. Two people monitoring the same performance or attribute should be able to arrive at the same reading. Finally, metrics should be easy to calculate, collect, and understand. They should be both effective and efficient information they convey. A metric that is too taxing to collect for the value of the information isn't a good metric. With today's appetite for information, there are countless ways to measure performance. Fortunately, information technologies make it much easier to gather data and to turn it into information than we've had in the past. But for reasons we'll explore, we need to keep our enthusiasm for data gathering and performance measurement in check. In this lecture, we'll focus on what I believe are the most meaningful measures to track in order to support your business. Let's step back for a moment and talk about why performance measurement is so important for an organization. Performance measures express the priorities of the organization and provide practical guidance for the work that we do every day. Rewards and punishments are often based on how individuals perform against established, communicated standards. If something has a standard and people are evaluated against that standard, people will naturally try to match or more often beat it. Sales goals offer a classic example. If we tell a salesperson he or she needs to beat last year's sales, well, right there, we have a target used to measure success or failure. That salesperson will be incented to surpass last year's sales goals. The goal and supporting measure convey the expected behavior. So a great place to start when devising a performance measurement scheme is to reflect on your organization's vision and supporting strategies. What is it that you're trying to accomplish? What outcomes are you seeking? And then what behaviors do we need from people to achieve them? I find that too often companies fall into the trap of measuring things that their competitors measure, or the things that external advisors and analysts think the organization should measure. When companies succumb to these forms of peer pressure, they take their eyes off the performance aspects that matter most to the company. A neat example is found in the famous book Moneyball and the movie by the same name. Billy Beane is the longtime general manager of the Oakland Athletics baseball team. In the early 2000s, he realized that the players that the team had been recruiting were not living up to their billing. They were underperforming. As general manager of a team with one of the lowest payroll budgets in Major League Baseball, which was about one-third that of the well-heeled New York Yankees, Beane and his organization couldn't afford to miscalculate on the prospects for talent. What he famously recognized was that rather than paying attention to conventional metrics of player performance and potential, one obscure statistic stood out as the best predictor of offensive capability in baseball: getting on base. Rather than poring over mountains of objective and subjective data, Beane and his colleagues drafted and signed what were undervalued players in the market based largely on that single metric. The Oakland A's went on to achieve great success in the years following the implementation of the on-base performance metric, and many other baseball teams soon emulated the strategy. As with the A's, the list of possible metrics that your organization could measure is truly limitless today. So you need to figure out what's important, and frameworks can be helpful in this regard. Robert Kaplan and David Norton devised a framework called the Balanced Scorecard in the 1990s, and it's gained a wide following. The Balanced Scorecard lays out four areas with which a company should concern itself for long-term growth and success. The premise is to incorporate financial and non-financial metrics in the assessment of performance. The creators of the Balanced Scorecard rightly noted that financial metrics are generally backward-looking and fail to direct a business forward. The non-financials help to ensure that the organization is poised for success into the future. So while financial performance is one dimension of the Balanced Scorecard framework, the other three dimensions include the areas of customer assessment, internal business process, and learning and growth. All four dimensions of the Balanced Scorecard are focused on the organization's vision and strategy. Let's take a look at the four dimensions and the metrics that one might use to gauge performance on each dimension. First off, financial performance. Financial measures are absolutely essential for any business, and all companies have a bevy of them. I often reference Yahoo Finance and what they call the financial highlights for a company to isolate the more important ones. Foremost on the list are measures of profitability, including profit margin and operating margin. Next are two measures of management effectiveness: the company's return on assets, or ROA, and return on equity, the ROE, which express profitability as ratios to total assets and shareholder equity, respectively. Next are several measures taken from the company's income statement, including revenues, revenue growth, gross profit, and earnings. The balance sheet offers reads on the company's cash position, debt, and leverage, or the ratio of debt to assets. Finally, the cash flow statement yields the operating cash flow and levered free cash flow, the cash left over after all obligations are covered. These metrics are the domain of financial accounting. And again, they provide really meaningful insights from the perspectives of shareholders and others with a financial interest in the company. From an operational standpoint, it's important to take a deeper look at the financials and try to interpret where your company is overextended or lacking coverage in its operations. For instance, you can take the revenue figure from the income statement and divide it by the inventory figure found on the balance sheet. As we learned previously, this gives you inventory turns, a measure of the efficiency of your operations. So if you generate $100,000 in sales and you hold $20,000 worth of inventory on average, then you achieve 100,000 divided by 20,000, or 5 inventory turns. You want to achieve more turns rather than fewer turns. If, for example, you can generate the same $100,000 in sales with only $10,000 worth of inventory on average, then you achieve 10 turns, and you can claim to be twice as efficient from an inventory standpoint. Getting by with less inventory, while still serving the customer well, allows you to free up cash that can be used in other ways in the business. Retail organizations often employ a similar measure for the efficiency of the company's sales force by dividing sales by the number of employees to get a sales per employee metric. Again, the more sales you can generate with fewer employees, the more efficient your business. Finally, for publicly traded companies, the share price is considered to be the most efficient measure of financial health, for it's a comprehensive measure of past, present, and anticipated future results. In financial speak, the share price reflects the net present value of all future cash flows on a per share basis. There are boundless assumptions built in there about efficiency of our financial markets and the transparency of company performance, but we as a society place a lot of faith in the stock markets to reflect company performance. That's why just about every news report of the day will mention the Dow Jones Industrial Average and NASDAQ numbers as a quick and dirty read on the business news of the day. When used in combination with other data points, financials offer rich insights, both for those outside and inside a business. However, it's important that we not stop with financial analysis alone. Let's turn to the customer assessment component of the balance scorecard next. We've long grown accustomed to the reality that the customer is king or queen. No business can remain vital and relevant without embracing a strong customer orientation, in competitive markets anyway. You have to be tuned in to the evolving taste of customers, and to the greatest extent possible, try to shape those tastes. Customer satisfaction is the most common measure for the customer perspective. To gauge it, marketers embrace a theory called the expectancy disconfirmation paradigm. According to the theory, customer satisfaction is a result of the degree to which customer expectations are either confirmed or disconfirmed by actual customer experiences with a product or service. When the perceived performance of a product or service meets or exceeds customer expectations, we say that the customer is satisfied. When perceived performance falls short of expectations, you guessed it, the customer is dissatisfied. Satisfied customers, and to a greater extent, delighted customers, are believed to become loyal customers. Loyal customers are the real gold that every business seeks, for they're often the most profitable segment. It costs less to market to them because they already know and like your company, its products, and its services. They tend to be resistant to the counterclaims of your competitors. They're often willing to be early adopters of your new products and services. And finally, they offer positive word-of-mouth endorsements to others. That free advertising can be among the most effective of all forms of advertising, since it comes from the mouths of peers, carrying with it a certain trustworthiness that you just can't buy. Companies measure customer satisfaction in different ways, but it almost always involves asking the customer how you did, usually following a specific transaction. Now, you've probably become pretty accustomed to receiving those little surveys by mail or email following a transaction. Auto service shops usually issue these short surveys, as do airlines after a service experience. It's their way of ascertaining your level of satisfaction while also trying to influence your perceptions. The company cared enough to ask, right? So that should amount to some degree of goodwill. Marketing researchers have learned that a simple, single question offers a good read on satisfaction. Are you ready for this? How satisfied were you with the recent experience? To learn about specific aspects of the transaction, you need to ask more questions. But the single global measure is sometimes good enough. Also, we usually scale these responses, meaning that we seek a measure that goes beyond the basic yes-no variety. We're looking for gradients of satisfaction, and we tend to use 5-point, 7-point, or 10-point scales to assess the relative degree of satisfaction. Something called the Net Promoter Score, or NPS, is gaining a lot of interest these days as a meaningful measure of satisfaction. Here again, one question is used. How likely is it that you would recommend our company to a friend or colleague? Customers respond on a scale of 0 to 10, with 0 meaning extremely unlikely to recommend, and 10 meaning extremely likely to recommend. Respondents showing scores of 0 to 6 on the question are called detractors, and they're regarded as disgruntled customers or former customers who are prone to spreading negative word of mouth about you, your products, or services. So-called passives are those with scores of 7 or 8. They're satisfied customers, yet susceptible to being swayed by competitors. Meanwhile, the promoters are the 9 and 10 respondents who demonstrate a zeal for the company and its offerings. These are the highly loyal customers that every company yearns for. The Net Promoter Score, then, is calculated by subtracting the percentage of detractors from the percentage of promoters. Clearly, you're looking for a positive number here, and the bigger the positive number, the better. Customer loyalty, as opposed to customer satisfaction, is best measured through actions rather than sentiments. Most telling is the percentage of repeat customers that your business enjoys. Do customers keep coming back? If so, with what frequency? And how much do they buy when they come back? Also, do they offer those referrals that a high satisfaction rating or NPS would suggest? These are all quantifiable measures of loyalty. And when customers do have a choice in competitive offerings, having loyal customers is the single best measure that you're doing the right things right in the eyes of customers. That said, it's important to keep asking customers about their levels of satisfaction and to keep monitoring behavior, because customers' taste and competitors' offerings can change over time. If you allow complacency, you're prone to stop innovating and find yourself in the business graveyard. Interestingly, many companies today are trying to determine the cost of poor service, also known as the cost of poor quality, or COPQ. This metric teeters on the financial side of the balanced scorecard, but is squarely focused on the cost of disappointing customers. It asks, what is the lost revenue if we disappoint a customer and they return an order or cancel an outstanding order? Some companies take it even further to consider the customer's lifetime value, meaning the lost revenue from losing a customer that never comes back. You can take the concept further still by thinking about how a bad customer experience can spread like wildfire through negative word of mouth, internet reviews, or blog postings that could affect the purchasing decisions of countless others. Now, these numbers can be a little tricky to calculate, but companies focused on stellar customer experiences are devising these kinds of numbers to emphasize the pursuit of perfect service and a projection of future sales. Let's turn our attention now to the third dimension of the balanced scorecard, the perspective of internal business processes. Of the four dimensions of the balanced scorecard, this is the one that focuses most intently on the work that every company performs every day to serve customers. How do we measure our business processes? The traditional metrics for business processes examine the productivity and efficiency of processes. Productivity can be equated to the yield of a process. A process that generates a lot of output is said to be a productive process. Efficiency, on the other hand, looks at the amount of output given some level of input. A process that generates the same output as another, but with fewer inputs, is regarded as more efficient. You might consider assessments of productivity and efficiency of business processes as the fundamental or basic measures for process performance. More recently, though, the operational excellence philosophies of Lean and Six Sigma are yielding valuable insights on the management of business processes. In fact, they de-emphasize the traditional focus on productivity and efficiency in favor of waste elimination and variation reduction. Let's revisit these philosophies and their respective approaches to process improvement in the performance measurement context. Lean thinking, you'll recall, is the management philosophy that seeks to eliminate waste in its various forms throughout the business. The seven forms of waste are often memorized through the mnemonic acronym Tim Wood, which stands for transportation, inventory, motion, waiting, overproduction, overprocessing, and defects. These are the seven forms of waste that the Toyota company famously sought to eliminate in the development of the Toyota production system more than 50 years ago. Focus is often directed to three of the waste: inventory, waiting, or time, and defects, for they're quite visible and influential with the remaining four waste. Identifying and measuring the waste allows you to assess the current state of a process. Through waste reduction or elimination, you can render, measure, and sustain improvement. Whereas Lean seeks to eliminate waste in work processes, Six Sigma seeks to reduce variation. Six Sigma relies on a five-step procedure for identifying improvement opportunities and seeing them through to implementation and sustained performance. The procedure is called the DMAIC method, standing for define, measure, analyze, improve, and control. These are the five phases of a Six Sigma project, and it's pretty similar to the procedure for hypothesis testing in scientific inquiry. The second phase of the procedure, measure, underscores the importance of assessing a process in its current state, as it undergoes improvement through fixing a problem at its root cause and then sustaining consistent, improved performance. A primary measure in the Six Sigma assessment is called DPMO, which stands for defects per million opportunities. A defect is a work step that falls outside of established tolerances. Something is performed in an unacceptable manner. Through observation and the collection of defect data, you can calculate the propensity to introduce defects into any process. As we've seen, Six Sigma performance dictates an extremely low level of defects. Six Sigma, in fact, refers to 3.4 defects per million opportunities. The more defects found in a process, the lower the sigma level. A process performing at one sigma, for instance, allows over 691,000 defects per million opportunities. As a customer, I think I'll pass on that process and its products. Highly automated manufacturing processes stand the best chance of achieving Six Sigma level performance. Processes that rely more on human effort tend to have lower thresholds, and some processes allow for a little more variation and less precision. When I go to a rock concert, personally, I like to hear some departure from the recorded versions of the songs. It should still sound like the music I paid to hear, but I welcome little variants. You know, things like that might upset a process engineer, but I actually seek them out. Lean and Six Sigma are finding widespread application in virtually every walk of life, from manufacturing to service environments, from for-profits to nonprofits, commercial, military, and government settings. Yes, even government. In Ohio, we have an initiative called Lean Ohio, where a small team of professionals applies Lean and Six Sigma principles to a myriad of business processes associated with running state government. In one example, they cut the number of process steps involved in recruiting and admitting a trooper to the state police academy from 235 steps to 34, eliminating more than 4 months from the process. This Lean and Six Sigma stuff really works, and it works anywhere. I've applied the methods myself in everything from Fortune 500 companies to schools and even the Ministry of Health in Botswana to improve the distribution of antiretroviral medicines in the treatment of HIV/AIDS. The fourth and final dimension of the balanced scorecard framework is related to the learning and growth perspective. This perspective focuses on the knowledge and capabilities of the people that compose the business. I assert that this is the least developed aspect of the framework, especially as it relates back to the vision and strategy of the organization. As is often said, the soft stuff is the hard stuff to manage. It's really difficult to get into the heads and hearts of people, including the people that we work with every day. Concerted effort has been made in recent years to better understand what drives an employee, and in seeking to align employees' interest and skills with the needs of the organization. The traditional focus of human resource departments was in recruiting new people into the organization, and included metrics like recruitment yield ratio, average time to fill a job vacancy, cost per hire, and employee turnover rate, leading to the need for recruiting in the first place. Increasingly, human resources departments are broadening their purview to include more than mere recruiting, but also retention and development of human capital, with the realization that companies compete on the quality of their people and their ideas. Hence, organizations today are much more oriented toward retaining the most talented people and developing them. This reinforces a culture of learning and growth. Other measures of retention that a company might examine include voluntary and involuntary termination rates and average tenure. Just as a company might survey customers to gauge their satisfaction and loyalty, it might survey its employees to measure their satisfaction and loyalty in working for the company. We might even ask them the Net Promoter Score question to see if they would recommend our products to friends and family. Metrics for employee development, meanwhile, include training cost or investment per employee, hours of training, and employee assessments of satisfaction with training and development, as well as the advancement opportunities that they see with the organization. Lean and Six Sigma very much incorporate the human element in process improvement. Lean, in particular, brings a very strong focus on safety and morale in the workplace. I would argue that safety is the foundation for learning and growth. The first form of safety is freedom from physical harm. If people don't feel safe in the workplace, you can't expect anything creative to come from them. In fact, you can't expect good concentration on what we call the standard work, let alone creative endeavor, when risks are found at every corner. So demonstrating that you care about the safety and well-being of your team members is of greatest singular importance. And to have metrics that speak to your commitment to well-being speaks volumes. Common metrics include days without a lost time accident, the number of reportable incidents, and also near misses. Like all metrics, these must be honest appraisals. And where you're coming up short, everyone should see it. For numbers that don't jive with perceptions won't be believed or honored anyway. Along with physical safety is the concern for a work environment that is free of other forms of threat, including harassment and the fear of losing one's job. There's not much that a company can do to shield itself from an economic downturn, but organizations today that seek the input of their people must shield them from fear of losing their jobs for speaking up on matters of all kinds. So many organizations have implemented metrics around complaints and resolution time, how long it takes to resolve a problem. Closely related to safety is morale. What is the general attitude of your team members? Do they come to work excited, ready to serve customers, and prepared to make things better? If not, you have a problem. Not only can absenteeism be a problem, but so too can presenteeism, where people are showing up to work but not truly engaged. In fact, this can be more difficult to measure than simply counting the no-shows. And it usually involves a survey conducted by an outside party in order to get the true sentiments of your people. To conclude our tour of the Balanced Scorecard framework and its four dimensions, keep in mind that these distinct perspectives on an organization interact a great deal with one another. And that's consistent with the whole idea of finding balance among the dimensions. The financial and non-financial aspects of the business tend to influence one another in the long run. Kaplan and Norton, the Balanced Scorecard's proponents, encouraged us to think more broadly in assessing business performance, beyond the dimension of finance, and to maintain a focus on the company's long-term vision and strategy, believing that if we have a clear vision and a good strategy and maintain adherence to those objectives, then we'll achieve desired performance reflected in bottom-line outcomes. A new frontier for performance measurement in business today is the area of sustainability. The idea of operating your company so that it and the world around it both have healthy futures. Sustainability suggests that the responsibilities of the organization should extend beyond its customers, employees, and shareholders. Rather, there's a broader set of stakeholders that we must concern ourselves with. Noted author John Elkington, in his seminal book titled Cannibals with Forks, prescribes a triple bottom line approach to measuring sustainable business performance. The first bottom line is the economic bottom line, and we've talked a good deal about that one already. In order for a business or any organization to thrive and survive, it must be able to maintain itself economically. The second bottom line is dedicated to the environment. An organization that considers the long-term environmental consequences of its actions will not only be a better corporate citizen, but one that people want to buy from and invest in. The third bottom line is that associated with the societal impact of business activity. This is the one that still lags, in my opinion, as we consider how various people are affected by business actions. As indicated in the growth and learning portion of the Balanced Scorecard, we're becoming more adept at considering how we manage and develop human capital. But our influence on outside stakeholders, like the larger communities in which our business operates, is far less understood and difficult to measure. Still, we must devise appropriate metrics to guide our decision-making on this critical dimension of business endeavor. As organizations adopt sustainability practices, they'll need to adapt their measurement systems to reflect all three of these bottom lines. Performance measurement is essential for driving our organizations toward their established goals, fulfilling our visions and strategies. The balanced scorecard provides a good way to organize our metrics. Within any one of these four dimensions, however, you could identify countless metrics. That's why it's important to devise a limited set of metrics within each of the dimensions. With too many metrics, you can find yourself driving through a snowstorm of data, which can be almost as dangerous as driving with your eyes shut. What you need to do is identify the key performance indicators. These are the metrics that everyone in the organization knows to be important. After all, good measurement requires a measured approach. By tracking key performance indicators, yet avoiding the temptation to measure what isn't truly relevant to your company's objectives, you can make your organization one that not only succeeds, but endures.
This lecture is titled, Keeping an Eye on Your Margins.
Running a business often involves making assumptions, but some assumptions can be dangerous. Consider these. All business is good business. Your biggest customers are your best customers. Small customers are less important customers. The missing piece of information leading us to make these assumptions is margin, the profit derived from each transaction. The gross margins can be a pretty easy number to calculate using figures from the income statement. They show the percentage of total sales that actually constitute profit. However, determining where the contributions to the gross margin come from in terms of products, services, and individual customers is anything but routine. In fact, I find that no more than 15%